Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We start with action at the state capitol. Lawmakers were busy this week, and so was our Capitol correspondent, Shayna Roth. Hello there.
Hello.
First, let's talk about Line 5. What exactly did Governor Rick Snyder agree to?
Well, Governor Rick Snyder made a deal with Enbridge, which is the owner of Line 5. And essentially, what they have come up with is this 99-year lease. And Enbridge is going to be responsible for sort of figuring out how to make a new line, put that line into a tunnel, and then bury that tunnel about 100 feet under the bedrock of the Straits of Mackinac, where this, you know, sort of controversial section of Line 5 currently is. So what they're saying is that Enbridge is going to pay for all of the construction and maintenance of this new line, and then that will then result in the current Line 5 portion under the Straits of Mackinac being decommissioned. It's all very up in the air right now. There are still plenty of agreements that have to be made. I spoke with a spokesperson from the House of Representatives, and he said they're still not sure, actually, if the state legislature needs to weigh in on this business deal or if this is something that just the administration can go through and deal with. There's also this sort of looming question of, you know, Snyder wants to get all of the T's crossed and the I's dotted before the end of his administration, but his days are very much numbered, and there is going to be a sort of changing of the guard very soon. And so depending on who, which candidates are in which office could determine whether or not this deal actually goes through or if it's already been finalized, if there are lawsuits. And no matter what the administration is, it's very possible that environmental groups will come through and file lawsuits against this deal because they're saying, no, this is not a good idea, even though you're putting it in a tunnel, which is, you know, the idea being it's this secondary enclosure so that if there is a leak, it doesn't go into the water, it goes into this tunnel. They're saying, even though you're doing that, you're still putting this sort of outside agent into the water, into our greatest natural resource, being the Great Lakes, and that's not good enough for us. You got to shut down Line 5. Don't put anything new in there. So it's very possible that we'll see lawsuits. So the deal was announced, but it is very far from over.
So we have that plan that Governor Snyder agreed to. And also, at the same time, state lawmakers were also passing new laws regarding pipelines.
Yeah, so there are these bills out there that were introduced in the state house, and they passed through the state house this week. So now they're going to the Senate, and they'll be hanging out there for a little while. And essentially, those would increase some reporting requirements that that these pipeline owners would have to do. The advocates of the bill say that they're going to make the lines safer. There's also some, you know, restrictions in there as far as anchor dropping and things like that. However, again, environmental groups say this just does not go far enough. At one point, one group kind of accused the Republican representatives that were sponsoring these bills, saying, you know, you're only interested in this because you have an election coming up, but you're not doing enough. Whereas the advocates for the group and the Republican lawmakers say, look, we're doing something. We are trying to make the lines safer while still ensuring that those resources are getting to the people that need them.
We are talking with Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth about what Michigan lawmakers were up to this week. I understand there are some new laws regarding HIV.
Yeah, so there's these bills also in the House. The House was the one that was kind of busy this week, not so much the Senate. But the House passed a group of bills that is sort of aimed at modernizing how Michigan treats HIV and sort of updating its policy. There are changes and updates for things like definitions and reporting requirements. But what's interesting is that there are two bills that are actually still in committee. They were originally part of this package. But now they're, you know, the rest of the package went on and was passed by the House, and these are still sitting in committee. And those would lower criminal penalties for people who knowingly and intentionally spread HIV to another person. So currently that's a felony. But advocates are saying, look, that if you make it a felony to do this, you know, that disincentivizes people from getting tested, and that, you know, there are people out there who are worried that they will get blackmailed for, you know, telling their partner they have HIV and then they break up, and then that, you know, all of a sudden they have criminal charges against them and people are alleging that they tried to spread HIV without telling people. So Representative John Hoadley is the bill sponsor, and he says, you know, let's make this a misdemeanor. Let's try and, you know, sort of take the criminal stigma away from HIV. And those are still in committee. I talked with the committee chair, and he says, you know, we're working on them. We want people to get tested. We don't want them to be afraid. But the bill still needs some work.
Thank you, Shayna, for staying on top of everything that happens at the Capitol.
Thank you.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR. Usually in the fall, the birds start to head south for the winter. But this year, dozens of bird scooters have descended on East Lansing and the MSU campus. The students love them, but local governments are not happy about how the business launched here. This fall at WKAR, we have a team of interns from MSU helping us cover issues in the Capital Region. Let's talk with one of them now, Honda Carter. Welcome to Current State, Honda.
Thank you for having me.
So first, describe these scooters and how do you activate them?
Well, Reginald, these scooters aren't motorcycle-like mopeds. They're kind of like the ones you stand on, motorized. Users download an app and pay for the time the scooter is in use, and then they leave it at their destinations.
And how fast do these scooters roll?
They go up to 15 miles per hour.
So from your observations, are students enjoying these scooters?
It seems like the students are liking the scooters better than the buses, which are free on campus.
So how many bird scooters were dropped off in East Lansing in September?
About 100 bird scooters were dropped off. Ted Fetters, Bird's Manager of Government Relations, told me the drop-off was unannounced.
We saw it as a great city and town to work in. We expected great demand, and we saw that demand through this pop-up, which is what we wanted to show.
He said the company only wanted to test their success in the city.
How have the bird scooters been received by the East Lansing City Council?
Well, the council held a public meeting on September 18th. They wanted to know how the company handles liability issues, safety issues, and what to do with scooters that are parked on sidewalks.
And what's next for the bird scooters in the council?
Fetters told me Bird intends to repair their communication with East Lansing.
You've been listening to Honda Carter, one of our WKAR interns, reporting on the bird scooters landing in East Lansing. Thanks for joining us, Honda.
Thank you.
But we're not done. Dozens of these scooters have been confiscated on the campus of Michigan State. So let's bring in another intern, Tatiana Hemphill. Welcome.
Thanks.
So Tatiana, how many scooters have been impounded by MSU police?
So far, there are currently, as of this morning, 140 scooters that are in the impound.
What's wrong with the scooters from the MSU police point of view?
I talked to MSU Police Captain Doug Monette, and he said that first there are some moving issues. They are motorized vehicles, so they're not allowed in bike lanes or sidewalks. And the scooters must operate on roadways where the speed limit is 25 miles per hour or lower. And also, the scooters are not allowed to be parked in bike racks or left on sidewalks. He told me that they're a visual hazard to drivers.
So the folks who own the bird scooters, what do they say about all of what MSU is doing?
They sent us a statement that says, quote, "As birds are impounded on campus, we will engage with university officials to investigate each incident and take necessary action. We look forward to continuing our work with the school to build a framework that supports safe, affordable, and accessible transportation options for each and everyone in the community."
Before you leave, Tatiana, have you or your friends tried riding one of these scooters?
I actually have not. A lot of my friends have, and they are saying that they're like ridiculously fast, and they more so drive them for the fun of it and not to get from like destination to destination, because they can be pretty fun.
Very interesting. Okay, you were listening to WKAR intern Tatiana Hemphill updating us on the confiscation of bird scooters on the MSU campus. Tatiana, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
This weekend, at least 1,400 people are dead following an earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia. Hard hit is the city of Palu, where 350,000 people, a population comparable to Tampa, Florida, were hit by a wall of water 20 feet tall. Joining us now is Wisnu Raja, president of the Indonesian Student Association at Michigan State University. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
First, may I ask, how is your family? Were they even near the area?
Yes, so Indonesia is an archipelago consisting of various islands. So this earthquake actually impacted the northern island of Sulawesi. And as you said earlier, it was heavily hit by the coastal city of Palu. My parents are in the capital city, Jakarta in Java, so they're not affected at all, so they're safe right now. But in Palu, it has definitely been a disaster impacting 70,000 people are homeless right now, and like you said earlier, 1,420 people are said to be the death toll by now.
As you know, Indonesia is a huge country of islands, and the land squared mileage is like Michigan, Alaska, and Texas together. For people who have not been to that part of the world, you know, what is it like?
Yeah, so Indonesia is located in Southeast Asia. We have a lot of tourists that come there just to see the magnificence of our landforms and the structures that have been formed in Indonesia. However, it sits directly along the Ring of Fire. It is in between tectonic plates that is colliding. So we have had a lot of earthquakes and a lot of tsunamis that we have faced in our history. In fact, just before this earthquake, there was one in the island of Lombok that had a death toll of 500.
How many students are in the Indonesian Student Association here at MSU?
So our Indonesian student population, undergrad and graduate combined, is roughly about 50.
How can people help? And are there any specific activities your group is putting together?
Currently, we are promoting 5 fundraisers that everyone can see and get more information through our website and our Facebook account. So what these fundraisers aim to do is basically help with a rescue and recovery effort, provide supplies, provide medical help to the people in need. What we're doing right now is to support these organizations that could help in providing a living standard for these people in trouble.
How tough is it for you to be here in Michigan and kind of look at what's happening there?
It is very tough for me because, like I said, I'm trying to promote Indonesia. I'm trying to show the beauty of Indonesia and really get have people be more aware of the importance Indonesia has in its geopolitical role. And again, when these disasters happen, it really saddens me that people get to see Indonesia in this light. And again, my hearts and my prayers go out to everyone that is being affected in this disaster.
And that was Wisnu Raja, president of the Indonesian Student Association at MSU. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
If you drink beer or eat fish, you may be consuming plastic.
The plastic itself transferred to the tissue. Do the chemicals associated with the plastic transfer to the tissue?
Coming up, how litter in the Great Lakes could be affecting our health. But next, Ernest Green reflects on a life of being a civil rights pioneer to seeing the first black president.
I never thought I would see that in my lifetime.
And this MSU alum talks about how the university will survive the Larry Nassar scandal.
University has to continue to point itself in change, positive change.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. Turn around, turn around, A 12th grader participated in a watershed moment in America's history 61 years ago. The Little Rock Nine were nine African-American students who racially integrated Little Rock's Central High School, despite violent and vulgar opposition from white mobs and the governor of Arkansas at the time. One of those nine is Ernest Green, who was awarded an anonymous scholarship to Michigan State University. And this week, he is back as the homecoming Grand Marshal. It's my pleasure and my honor to speak with Mr. Green here at WKAR. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I know you've been asked about the moments of trying to integrate so many times, but if you had a word to describe that moment or some of the days that you went through, what would you say that word would be?
Well, the initial confrontation with the Arkansas National Guard, it was a shock. We didn't expect that. Little Rock and the state of Arkansas also, and Orville Faubus, had different sort of reputations. They had a reputation of being moderates, that Little Rock had integrated the buses the summer before. The library had been integrated without series of problems. The University of Arkansas had admitted a few black students to both the medical school and the law school. So our expectations were that, sure, there were people opposed to it, but there wasn't going to be the confrontation that existed. And what occurred was that the governor called out the Arkansas National Guard the night before we were to go to school. Everyone else had thought that they had worked out an arrangement that we would be able to go to school that September 4th. And as it turned out, there were soldiers there with drawn bayonets that kept us out. Admitted white students, but kept us out. And the thought that went through my mind, I'm the only one of the nine that's in the 12th grade, was I going to be able to graduate? And, you know, I had laser concentration on this being my last year of high school.
The theme of this year is homecoming is unwavering courage. Did you feel courageous right at that time, or was it something that you realized later in life looking back at that moment?
I knew this was an important moment, and I knew enough about changes going on in the South. I mean, I grew up with the murder of Emmett Till. I recognized the social changes that Jackie Robinson and others in athletics brought. I knew that we were on the verge of a different set of relationships, and that one of the things that occurred, I remember when the 54 decision was handed down, our local newspaper said this was going to change the face of the South forever. And I thought in my teenage brain, hey, this was a good thing. If it's going to change the face of the South, I want it to change quickly. But, you know, again, that was a court decision and nobody had any ideas how it was going to be implemented.
We are talking with Ernest Green, one of the Little Rock Nine, and the 2018 MSU Homecoming Grand Marshal. Not only did you earn both master's and bachelor's degrees in sociology here at MSU, you served as Assistant Secretary of Labor under President Carter. You're back here on this campus, and 10 years ago this week, Barack Obama campaigned for the presidency, and a month later, he was elected to be first African-American president and served two terms. And what is it to be such a participant in history to seeing Barack Obama as president?
Well, I never thought I would see that in my lifetime. And I also, a friend of mine said, we elected a black president and sent a man to the moon, and we still have problems. That this is really a long distance run, not a sprint. And I think President Obama accomplished phenomenal things. I mean, I was I had an opportunity to go to Chicago the night that he accepted the results from the election. And, you know, it was just, you had tears in your eyes because this was a watershed that many of us never thought would be accomplished. However, you realize that that in itself is part of the game-changing activity. There's no single item that you can point to that says everything is fixed. But what I hope, you know, your audience, as well as many of the students around, that they see their role, ability to make changes. They've got to step up personally to the plate. They got to be willing to have people understand that the civic stuff, you know, like voting and being concerned about group participation really requires your interest. Anybody that stays home may as well have voted for the opposition. I think that one of the main issues that we discover is how difficult it is to shake the legacy of slavery. And that our views about race, about changes, all get affected by how a portion of this country wants to hold on to the past, whether it's the Charlottesville far right, others, candidates who are running for office as right-wingers. Orville Faubus tried that back in 1957. It didn't work well for him then. It's not going to work well for anybody going forward with it. But we have to keep pressing the case.
You are coming to your alma mater, MSU, but it's still healing from the Larry Nassar investigation and case and everything. Do you have any advice for students and folks on this campus who've had to face some real pain?
Well, I think you have to continue to support the students who are pressing for change. Obviously, NASA is a period that you shudder and wish never happened, but it did. And we have to be willing to face up to that and also point out how we're going to make a change for the future. Michigan State, to me, is a place that's poised to be more about the future than the past, whether it's agriculture, recognizing what a huge industry that is. I said, if you look at the recent acquisition of Whole Foods by Amazon, Amazon hadn't made many bad bets. And if they see grocery stores as a opportunity, it must point out to some people that food production, manufacturing, all of that is a industry of the future. Michigan State's in a great position to help the country as well as the world to figure out how to have more nutritional food, how to feed itself, how to take care of areas of the world where food production is something in space. Our engineering activity, the needs for infrastructure in this, not in, just in this country, but in this world, is something that this university has an opportunity to show what it's made of. And I think university has to continue to point itself in change, positive change, to put the past, the awful deeds that a person like NASA did and try to move beyond that.
Well, it's been a pleasure and an honor to talk with you. It's Ernest Green, one of the Little Rock Nine and the 2018 MSU Homecoming Grand Marshal. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Go Green.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I know that I do believe.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR. Does it seem like we are more politically divided than ever? This week I found these soundbites from a pro-President Trump rally and from a demonstration against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh.
Because I want to show my support for President Trump and his agenda.
We need to get Judge Kavanaugh confirmed.
He's done exactly what he said he would do.
You think the danger is that Republicans lose women voters for a generation?
A generation? We'll never forget this.
I think that the way in which this vote has been moved forward on this candidate, I think it's appalling.
Zachary Neal has done more than just listen to the rhetoric. He is an associate professor of psychology and global urban studies at Michigan State University, and he's here now to talk about a study of 40 years of growing political polarization. Zachary, welcome to Current State.
Thanks for having me.
So why did you start your research in 1973?
Well, it brings us back about 40 years, and that's where we start to see the current trend toward what we see today as extreme political polarization. That's where the trend really seems to have gotten started. And so I start there and look up to the present day to try and understand exactly how bad has it gotten.
And what were some major observations that you've made?
Well, everybody, I'm sure, knows that we're seeing fairly extreme political polarization, and certainly I see that in this research as well. What was particularly striking is that we can't point the finger at any particular political party. We've seen this polarization increase in Republican-controlled Congresses and Democratic-controlled Congresses. So what it seems to be suggesting is the main thing that's bipartisan in Congress today is increasing polarization. Over this 40 or 50-year period I've been looking at, starting in the early 70s, it's been a relatively smooth trend. Each year we see increasing polarization. Now, it's not so much the case that we didn't see any polarization in the 1970s. Certainly, the Republicans mainly worked with other Republicans, and the Democrats mainly worked with the other Democrats in the 70s and 80s. But we saw a lot more bipartisan collaboration across the aisle. And what I've noticed is that in the 2000s, and really ramping up in just the past 4 or 5 years, that bipartisan collaboration has almost completely vanished. It's incredibly rare to see collaboration across the aisle between Republicans and Democrats. In fact, what this research suggests is that bipartisan collaboration we used to see has actually been replaced with some animosity, with some actual attempts to avoid collaborating and to undermine the opposing party's legislation.
We are speaking with Zachary Neal, Associate Professor of Psychology and Global Urban Studies at Michigan State University, talking about political polarization. I remember in the 1980s, we had Ronald Reagan, staunch Republican, and of course, Tip O'Neill, Democratic Speaker of the House. And I just remember even news reports about collaboration and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. We used to hear at least a bit more about bipartisan collaboration and the passage of major legislation. One of the other trends that we've seen change is the size of the margin between the controlling political parties. Certainly, we see that today in the Senate, and it's become a key feature of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, is the razor-thin margin by which the Republicans hold the Senate. So that has some implications when we see polarization at this extreme level. What we'll sometimes see is a party pass their agenda, bring some of their relatively extreme legislation, and get it passed. However, once another party takes control of the Congress, say, a couple years later, their first act is to attempt to repeal that. And so we still see legislation getting passed, but it often never fully gets implemented, maybe doesn't take effect. And that brings us into something like a legislative stalemate.
Who did you talk to and what did you observe for your research?
So for this work, I've been focused on patterns of bill co-sponsorship in both the House and the Senate. So as a piece of legislation gets introduced, other colleagues in Congress can sign on in support of that legislation. And so to understand these patterns of collaboration and opposition in Congress, I've been focused on the extent to which members of each party choose to co-sponsor bills introduced by their same party colleagues and the extent to which they co-sponsor bills introduced by the other party.
Who would you think of as a moderate or centrist politician these days?
Well, certainly much of our attention right now is focused on the moderates, the centrists in Congress. For example, Susan Collins of Maine. And certainly in my research, I can see her centrist position play out in her pattern of co-sponsorships and her pattern of collaborations and oppositions among her colleagues in Congress. So if we think about what it might take to undo this pattern of increasing polarization in Congress, I think part of the solution is to look to centrist or more moderate candidates. The challenge, again, though, is that as the electorate becomes itself more polarized, those moderate or centrist platforms become less and less popular among voters. And so it becomes more difficult for them to really gain a foothold when it comes time for elections.
Why does research like this matter?
I think it matters because it calls people's attention to the fact that it's gotten worse. And there was a time when it was better, when politics didn't look the way it does now. And I'd like to think it gives us hope that we can return to that at some point.
Well, thank you, Zachary Neal, Associate Professor of Psychology and Global Urban Studies, talking about his study of political polarization in the U.S. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Up next.
I am digging and just finding more and more, like whole bottle caps.
The link between plastics, our Great Lakes, and your health. Plus, a teacher from Jackson shares an emotional story about random acts of kindness.
And I want to tell you a story about two of my students.
You are listening to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick. If you drink beer or water or eat fish, you may be consuming microplastic. This plastic waste, as its name suggests, is tiny. It's part of the tide of plastic trash littering land, oceans, rivers, and our Great Lakes. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, scientists are trying to find out if it's a threat to animals and people.
Lake Ontario sparkles on a sunny day, lapping at Toronto's park-lined shore. But the lake has a dirty underbelly, and that's what interests ecologist Chelsea Rockman. Rockman and her student Kennedy Bucci have come to the edge of an inlet that's covered with washed-up debris. An apartment building looms overhead. Rockman squats down and reaches into the muck with her bare hands.
I am digging and just finding more and more, like whole bottle caps. This is insane.
It's so ingrained in the soil.
They're digging for small pieces of plastic and tossing them into a jar. Rockman is an ecologist and researcher at the University of Toronto. Her passion is to find where plastic waste is coming from and how it gets into the food chain, the chain that feeds us. She inadvertently picks up something she wishes she hadn't.
Oh.
That's why I gave you the glove.
It is a dirty business, but Rockman has always loved cleaning up. She remembers how, as a child, she puzzled her parents by volunteering to clean house. In high school in Arizona, she got even more ambitious.
I used to take my friends into the desert and clean up a mile of trash every Earth Day. I remember finding weird old dolls and strange old toys that I thought were creepy, but then I would also keep.
As a graduate student, she got a trip on a research vessel to visit the infamous floating garbage patch in the Pacific Ocean. She and the other scientists were supposed to count the plastic as it drifted by.
So everyone runs up to the bow and they're like, there's trash, everyone start counting the trash. And so we all start counting the trash and we're looking and it's like basically like a soup of confetti of tiny little plastic bits everywhere. And everyone just stopped counting, like sat there, looked at, like back up against the wall and just were like, okay, this is A, this is a real issue. B, it's not an island of trash you can pick up. And C, the tiny stuff for me was, as an ecologist, oh, this is really getting into the food chain. You can spend a whole career studying this stuff.
So she did, especially microplastic. Pieces you can barely see. Consider that since the mass production of plastic in the mid-20th century, 8 billion tons have been manufactured. And when it's thrown away, it doesn't just disappear. Much of it crumbles into small pieces. It ends up in soil, in fertilizer, in rivers, lakes, and oceans. At one of Rockman's labs, Kennedy Bucci prepares to make her own microplastic from the morning's collection. So what we have here is a coffee grinder and some ugly-looking black plastic.
So this is the plastic that I feed to the fish to measure their effects.
That includes the tiniest fish, fish larvae. She's got a bunch in a beaker of water that also contains ground-up plastic particles. Under a microscope, the larva's gut is translucent. We can see right into it.
It's like a big teardrop with a fish stuck in it.
Mm-hmm. You can see kind of a line of black, weirdly shaped black things. Those are the microplastics.
Yeah, I can see that. Definitely see that. Definitely two or three places.
Oh, is it black?
Yeah.
In another lab, the team keeps hundreds of grown-up fish in bubbling tanks stacked 6 feet high. They're fathead minnows. Bucci says they make good test subjects.
They just kind of end up eating whatever is floating around in front of them. So if you stick your finger in there, they'll all eat your finger.
They try. Luckily, they don't have teeth. But they don't need teeth to eat microplastic. It's like a soup in rivers and lakes and oceans, a chemical soup. Plastic can shed the chemicals it's made from. It also attracts other chemicals in the water that latch onto it, toxic industrial compounds like PCBs, for example. Tracking all those chemicals is researcher Clara Tyson's job.
So right now we're starting with the common types of plastic, so polyethylene, polypropylene, polystyrene, but there's tons. This happens all the time. You invent something that seems really great, and then you don't think, and we've become so dependent on it.
Rockman says testing what plastic does to the tissues of fish matters not just to the fish, but to us.
We eat fish that eat plastic, so it's this question of, are there things that transfer to the tissue? Does the plastic itself transfer to the tissue? Do the chemicals associated with the plastic transfer to the tissue?
In fact, plastic does get into fish tissue. Plastic fibers from clothing, for example. There's a lot in fleece. Rockman found fibers in fish from San Francisco Bay. She bought a washing machine for her lab and washed fleece clothing, and lots of fibers came out. And it's not just in the water, it's even floating in the air.
If you put a piece of double-sided sticky tape on the lab bench for an hour, you come back and it's got four plastic fibers on it.
So far, they do know that microplastic particles can sicken or even kill larvae and fish.
The things we don't know, what are all the sources where it's coming from so that we can think about where to turn it off? And once it gets in the ocean, where does it go? Which is super important, because then we can understand how it impacts wildlife and humans.
Rockman says she's ready to spend the rest of her career finding out. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Food is the language everyone speaks, but do we truly understand it?
Between the conversations over organic food and GMOs, different diets taking the world by storm, and how what we eat actually impacts our environment,
there's no shortage of things to learn about. Hi, I'm Karel Vega.
And I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum, and this is Serving Up Science.
Here on the program, we talk about the science behind foods and sometimes the history too. But to even be able to enjoy food, there is one indispensable part of your body, and that part is your teeth.
So today, we're speaking with Dr. Jason Mashney. He's a dentist based in East Lansing, full disclosure. He's my dentist, and he's here to answer all of our questions related to teeth. Dr. Mashney, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We hear about what to eat all the time on TV, online, and maybe a couple times a year at the dentist's office, usually when our mouth is open and it's hard to ask questions. So we have you here today. Tell us what we should be eating for good oral health.
There's general principles to avoid and prevent dental disease. Things that we can touch on are things like creating a good environment for your teeth, things like the acidity of products that we don't always think about, the sugar in certain products, the makeup of, you know, what we're drinking is very important that we don't always think about. And there are certain foods that are better as snacking foods or other things like that. Generally, things that are lower in sugar, even higher in protein, are better snacks, things like cheeses or even meats, things like that, that can really reduce the risk of having some issues.
And you mentioned acidity. So do different people have different natural pH in their mouth? And does that affect our oral health?
Yes, I'm glad you asked. The environment of your mouth is really what controls, you know, our dental disease. So cavities, getting a cavity or decay, is caused by a bacterial infection. And that bacteria grows in a certain environment. Bad bacteria grow in an acidic environment. There is good bacteria in your mouth, just like in our bodies. So there's other things that many people don't realize are acidified. So all of our canned foods have to be acidified for shelf-like purposes. So every canned food that you get, including for baby food, okay, is in the range of 4.5. The strange thing that most people don't know is bottled water. When we go to the store and buy bottled water, we have to think about what we're buying. So that bottled water usually is not fluoridated, and it's made by, some of them are made by soda companies, Dasani, aka Coca-Cola. That water is in the range of 4.5 again. Coca-Cola is in the range of 3, but if we are, you know, having dry mouth or we're giving our kids just bottled water, that can even be an issue.
We're speaking with Dr. Jason Mashney. He's a dentist based in East Lansing who's here today to answer all of our teeth-related questions. What's the biggest issue or threat you're seeing with your patients these days?
Dental decay, periodontal disease, and really just understanding how that plays a role in overall health. Dental decay, that's really the most common thing that people somewhat understand, but it's the number one disease in children, okay? And if we're doing our job, we should see those things go down, okay? The number of decay in our practice, or all practices, go down. We have fluoridation, we have trying to educate people, but for the most part, dentists are not going out of business. So prevention, giving this understanding to our patients, is very important, where we don't learn a lot of these things in dental school.
You mentioned fluoride, and that's something that I'm curious about because I grew up in New York. Everyone got fluoride on their teeth, and the water, of course, had fluoride as well. I moved to Michigan from California, where the dentists didn't use fluoride, and there was a lot of concern about the fluoride that was added to water. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about why fluoride is good for our teeth?
I love talking about this because there is some controversy about it, but ultimately we do have good research supporting our beliefs. Fluoride is one avenue to reduce dental decay. It's not the only avenue. We talked about acidity. Your tooth structure is made up of blocks, building blocks, okay? And in a certain acidity, the real number's 5.5, okay? Those building blocks get taken away. A cavity starts, okay? So every time you drink a sip of your Coca-Cola or other things, that is taking away parts of your tooth. What fluoride does is it reinforces those building blocks. So that number, the critical pH of 5.5, can be raised to 6 or higher with our fluoride. But like I said, there are other things besides fluoride.
We've been speaking with Dr. Jason Mashney. He's a dentist who practices in East Lansing. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us today.
You've been listening to Serving Up Science, the show all about food, where it comes from, and how it impacts our health and our planet.
This program is produced at Michigan State University in association with food at MSU. And for an extended version of our conversation with Dr. Mashney, visit WKAR.org.
I'm Cheryl Kirschenbaum.
And I'm Karel Vega, and this is WKAR.
And you can hear new episodes of Serving Up Science Wednesdays at 4:45 and 6:45 p.m. during All Things Considered on 90.5 WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. You're listening to Current State from WKAR. Let's take a time out now from all of the negativity. People from across Michigan attend our pop-up stories events to share experiences. During our last event at the Ella Sharp Museum in Jackson, we listened to stories of random acts of kindness. One of our storytellers is Dr. Clinton Bartholomew. He is a scientist who traded his lab coat for a high school classroom, and he discovered negative stereotypes he had heard about young people couldn't be farther from the truth. Here is Dr. Bartholomew's story.
So I spent the first decade and a half of my adult life cloistered away behind a laboratory desk. Yes, I was a lab rat, spent some time down in Nashville studying how cells divide. I spent a little bit of time doing anti-aging research at the University of Michigan. However, 6 years ago, I made a big change. No longer would I be talking to stuffy scientists. I would be talking, yes, to high school students. From that laugh, I know you've heard things about high school students. This quote came to mind, and my friends reminded me of it. Speaking of the children in their time, the children now love luxury. They have bad manners. They show disrespect for elders, and they love to chatter in places of exercise, .. They terrorize their teachers, end quote. So when I began to teach, I was worried. 4 years ago, I started teaching over at Jackson College, at Jackson Preparatory and Early College. And I want to tell you a story about two of my students. We will call them Bella and Mary. First class they had in the science area was a general biology class. I began to be worried because halfway through the week, at the end of the day, they showed up at my door. Doc B, we need some help. Really? Isn't it the first week of class? Oh, yeah, we need help. Can you come in and help us? I knew what this was. Sure, I'll be there at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. You guys show up. And they did. 8 o'clock, they came in. Doc, we are totally lost in this class. Can you help us? I knew what this was. I had taught with, even before this. They wanted the answers. They wanted my help. They immediately pulled out their notes. What we don't understand is this question by the teacher. What was going on here? This continued throughout the entire semester. Every week, they would show up. Doc, can you help me? They were asking amazing questions. Everything was brilliant. I wrote their letters of recommendation, volunteer hours, just hundreds of them. And we wonder, this is not what we expect from high school students. You see, for my students, I don't see random acts of kindness. I see lives lived in consistent kindness. I remember the day that I sat there as both of them walked across the stage, one of them valedictorian, who gave me a shout out. You see, we do not have young men and young women that are bad. We have ones that teach us. They teach their teachers how to care, and how to go the extra mile. Thank you.
That was Dr. Clinton Bartholomew of Jackson sharing his story on the theme of random acts of kindness. And we invite you to tell a story at our next event on October 25th at the Herbert Herman Cancer Center in Lansing. We want to hear your story of how you or your loved one was touched by cancer. Please go to WKAR.org or the WKAR News Facebook page to sign up to tell a story. And with that beautiful music, we'll say goodbye. I'm Reginald Hardwick, Digital News Director at WKAR. And for the entire news team, thank you for joining us. And we will connect with you again next weekend.